Mr. Delcroix was in agreement that if he continued to serve those two routes for 2 years, at the end of 2 years, he would, in addition to his regular compensation, get a bonus of $30,000 plus an opportunity to share in the profits of those two routes. There were two promises that Mr. Delcroix made to get that good package. At least two promises, the two promises at issue in this case. The first promise was he agreed that when he left the employment of Star, he would not solicit its customers. By customers, they agreed the people who had been customers during the past year. That was limited to only people who had been customers in the past year if Mr. Delcroix had ever dealt with them on behalf of Star, or if Mr. Delcroix had some special knowledge about them. The second promise that Mr. Delcroix made was that he would agree that for 2 years after he left the employment of Star, he would not engage in a substantially similar business or competitive business within the 50-mile territory that he had agreed to develop and prosper for Star. Well, Mr. Delcroix worked for 2 months, 2 years, and a little more, and he collected the $30,000. And then what he did is he stopped coming to work. When he stopped coming to work, he started, even before he resigned, soliciting the customers that had been customers within the last year, and he started his own business serving the exact same territory that he had agreed not to serve, that he'd been serving for Star. So it's that conduct, that secretive conduct in violation of those two promises, that brought this case to court in the first place. And we're here today to look at a couple of different issues. Basically, we're here to look at whether that first promise, that non-solicitation clause, is reasonably necessary to protect the legitimate interest of Star. If it is, it's an enforceable covenant not to compete.
Excuse me, Mr. Shoemaker, do we know, though, that Mr. Delcroix, the items that he was selling after he left Star Direct, do we know that those were in direct competition with his former employer?
We do. The record shows that they were the exact same products. Some of the products he was selling, the record shows, were the same products at a slightly lower price.
Mr. Shoemaker, the business clause, I believe, contains language about substantially similar business. What does that mean?
And you're talking about the second covenant, not to compete, what I would call a traditional non-competition clause. It says he's not going to engage in a business that's substantially similar or competitive. Substantially similar is clear and unambiguous.
Is it defined at all in the agreement?
It's defined in Black's Law Dictionary. Substantial similar means essentially the same. Essentially the same business. He agreed that he would not engage in essentially the same business or a competitive business. Now, frankly, I think the two are a little bit redundant. I think the drafter might have been able to simply say he agrees he will not engage in a competitive business, and that probably would have been good enough. But as you know, lawyers sometimes do a little more. We say null and void. We say full and complete release. I think in this case, the drafter said a substantially similar business and a competitive business. You could have a competitive business that is not substantially similar. For example, you could be selling the same products over the internet, or some of the same products over the internet, or in some other way that's not substantially similar. But if a business is substantially similar, if it is essentially the same as Star's business, it is by its nature competitive. And one of the problems the Court of Appeals had with this case is it took that phrase substantially similar and I think adopted an argument that Mr. Delcroix made that I believe was really a flawed syllogism. We know that what the Court of Appeals said is Star was engaged in the business of distributing consumer products to convenience stores, gas stations, and travel centers. And then it said that a business that sells beer and bread and gasoline, which are products Star does not sell, is engaged in the business of selling consumer products to gas stations, travel centers, and service stations. Therefore, the Court of Appeals said, the covenant not to compete precludes Mr. Star, Mr. Delpra, from engaging in a business that sells even products Star doesn't sell, like bread and gasoline and beer. Therefore, the Court of Appeals said, the covenant's too broad. It's unreasonably necessary to protect the interest of Star because Star has no legitimate interest in preventing Mr. Delpra from having a beer truck and delivering beer. It has no legitimate interest in preventing Mr. Delpra from delivering gasoline or bread. So the problem with the Court of Appeals decision was that flawed reasoning. It's sort of like somebody saying Bob Shoemaker is engaged in the practice of law in Madison, Wisconsin. And then saying the attorney who argued the first case is engaged in the practice of law in the state of Wisconsin. And then the Court of Appeals saying Bob Shoemaker and the attorney who argued the same case are engaged in substantially the same business. Simply not true. I don't practice criminal law. I don't do that kind of work. So it was a flawed syllogism that caused the Court of Appeals to conclude that the second covenant not to compete was overbroad. And what we have in this case is Mr. Delpra trying to get out of those promises that he made by doing exactly what this court said you should not do in Wysocki. In Wysocki, the Supreme Court said, a covenant not to compete is really a contract case, and you must give a covenant not to compete a reasonable interpretation, and you cannot try to interpret it in such an unreasonable way by saying somebody who sells beer and gasoline is substantially similar to the business that Star is in, to give it that unreasonable, strained interpretation, and then come back and say, aha, it's unenforceable because it's unreasonable and it's overbroad.
Counsel, to me, the argument that you're advancing deals with what I call the levels of generality. To say that you and the counsel from this earlier morning's argument are substantially similar, if you're comparing, depending on your lens, if you're comparing are you attorneys who practice law versus investment bankers, well, it's substantially similar. So it all depends on how general you want the category or how narrow you want the category. You can advance that you're substantially similar because they both deliver to and deal with convenience stores. That's one level. So my question to you is, how do you make, if at all, a principled drawing of the line as to what level of generality is acceptable and what level of generality isn't? Is that possible?
Yes.
Good. Come on.
We'll go back to the Wysocki case again, which said at its core, covenant not to compete are contracts. So we apply the ordinary rules of interpreting a contract. First, we look at the language of the contract. Is it clear and unambiguous? I would suggest to you, that's the first step, we'll go to some other steps if you're not satisfied with that. First step, look at what substantially similar means. Substantially similar. I think they mean essentially the same. Check the
compared to what?
Well, let's go on.
Okay.
And compared to what? So I think a court in construing that, looking at what it means, it's ambiguous or not, whether it's reasonably susceptible to different means. Is somebody who drives a beer truck and delivers beer doing substantially similar things to them? I would say not. I think it's clear and unambiguous. But if a court is uncertain about that, then we have other rules of construction to apply. One is to look at the contract themselves and see how the parties use the terms. In this particular case, there's another covenant not to compete, including one that applies during the term of his employment. And it says, during the term of his employment, Mr. Delprat, while he's still employed with them, will not engage in any business distributing any consumer products. And I'm paraphrasing a little by inserting the words any, but that's basically what it says. So they're saying, while you're employed by us, we don't want you selling consumer products to any convenience stores. And you understand why you'd want that to be the case, because you want them to focus on selling your products, not something else on the side to your customers. But then, when they talked about 2 years after, they used the words, 2 years after, you'll not engage in any business that's substantially similar or competitive. So we show that we see that they use two different terms, and obviously to give them two different meanings. So that's one rule of construction we have. A third rule of construction is that a covenant not to compete must be construed narrowly against the restraint. And there's a problem here that I think the Supreme Court can address in this case. Because when we face these cases in circuit courts, we sometimes have people arguing the covenant not to compete must be construed against the employer. So what does that mean when you're trying to determine whether the covenant is too broad or not? Does that mean you construe it in the most restrictive way so that you can then conclude it's unenforceable? Or does that mean you construe it in the most narrow way so that it might be enforceable? And I believe the law is, we cite some cases, that a covenant not to compete, which is a restraint of trade, must be construed in the most narrow way against the restraint. So it must be interpreted in the most narrow way so that it's not overly restrictive. Now, I've heard some people suggest to me that we construe it narrowly when we're going to apply it, but we construe it broadly when we're trying to see if it's enforceable or not. Well, that doesn't make sense. We have to use the same rule of construction to decide what substantially similar means, whether we're on offense trying to enforce the covenant or on defense trying to restrain it. Just like in football, when you ask for whether it's a first down or not, you use a 10-yard chain, whether you're the offense or the defense. So to keep answering your question, Justice Bradley, one of the ways that we address that question, what does substantially similar mean? We have to construe it narrowly against the restraint. So we have what I think is the clear and ambiguous term. We have how the parties used it in their contract. And we have the rule that a covenant not to compete has to be construed narrowly. So I think, Justice Bradley, that's how you decide what substantially similar means. And I hope that I've answered that question.
So the Court of Appeals used your technique and said you have to look at the rest of the contract to see what substantially similar means. And then they said in paragraph 14 that the first provision of the first section of the agreement provides employer is presently engaged in the business of distribution of products to convenience stores, service stations, truck stops, and travel centers. And that it says that the employee may not become engaged in the business of the employer, that being distribution of consumer products to service stations and or convenience stores. Then this is where I think you say there's a leap here. But the Court of Appeals said nowhere in the agreement is the employer's business defined by the particular products. It says we distribute consumer products undefined to particular kinds of retail establishments. And then the Court of Appeals goes on to say, hey, that covers any product that would be sold for consumers.
So I go back to the three sentences you quoted. The first one is just an acknowledgement. We, Star distributors, are engaged in the business of consumer products. Maria Wisconsin Corporation, whatever. They stated what their business was. Then the second clause that you read, Justice Abramson, was from the covenant not to compete during the term of the employment.
Mm-hmm.
And they said you will not engage in any business that sells consumer products.
Where in the business agreement or in the covenant does it describe the kinds of products?
It doesn't.
And what year does it, would it matter? Would it matter if they change from month one to two? So it doesn't describe the product. So Star could sell cigarettes in 1 month and then say no more cigarettes and then sell Oreo crackers.
Right. And
cookies,
I should say. And there's a good reason why a covenant not to be would not specify all of the products they sold, and why in that covenant not to compete afterwards they use the term substantially similar. Because the products that they sell change over time.
Sure.
I mean, they might sell ice scrapers, sunglasses,
sure.
lighters.
Sure, whatever they can buy expensively and sell
right.
it off.
Right.
I
so,
agree.
So, the parties,
doesn't that mean he can't do anything with consumer products and service stations or convenience stores?
Only if you accept what I think is a flawed syllogism, that any business that sells consumer products to a convenience store is substantially similar to Star. And I think that's a flawed syllogism.
Just agreed that Star has a whole assortment of consumer products, and they change, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how do I know what I can sell to PDQ and not risk violating this?
Yep. The record in this case includes Mr. Del Pra's deposition.
Pardon? Yes.
The record in this case includes his deposition, and I believe it includes questions. Well, Mr. Del Pra, did you understand this agreement to mean that you could sell beer after you left? Yes, I did. Why was that? Because we didn't sell beer. I'm paraphrasing. Did you understand, Mr. Del Pra, that you could sell bread after you left? How do you? Yes, I did. How do you know? Because that's not a product we carried. So in this case, a fourth level of deciding what substantial similar means is the party's intent, the meaning they gave to it. And ultimately, Justice Abramson, if there was an issue in this case about whether Mr. Del Pra was doing something that was substantially similar, that would ultimately be a fact issue for a trial. But we don't need that in this case because he conceded in his deposition that he knew this meant he could sell beer, he could sell bread, he could sell those other kinds of products. And I think the practical problem, you have a question, I don't mean to interrupt.
Finish.
I think the practical problem is how could a business like Star draft the covenant not to compete that included every product that it might sell between now and the time he leaves his employment? So the drafter of this did the best that he could following the law, trying to make the covenant protect the legitimate interest of Star. You cannot be engaged in a competitive business.
And there's a third.
You cannot engage in a substantially similar business.
There's a third party here, though, and that is people who are going to deal with Del Pra. So if I'm going to buy from Del Pra, I don't want to be caught dealing with him when he's violating his covenant because you could sue me too,
yeah.
Right?
I think I could sue you if you were intentionally and tortiously.
Yeah, so I look at this and I say to myself, oh, I don't know what this means, substantially. They become engaged in the business of the employer. I don't know what Star is selling every single day. I know I'm a convenience store and Del Pra's coming in and wants to sell me beer. So why should I take Del Pra's word that beer isn't covered? I look at the contract and read it. Covers everything that's sold to, because the business is selling to convenience stores.
But the contract doesn't say it covers everything. The contract says it covers being engaged in a business that's substantially similar. And I think that the reasonable person, whether you're a convenience store owner, Mr. Del Pra, Star, a judge, a juror, knows that there's a business that delivers beer to convenience stores is not substantially similar to the guy who comes in and says, we have some sunglasses, we have some hats, we have some lighters, and so on. I think that the people in the convenience store business and everybody else knows that a Budweiser distributor is not substantially similar to Star. I think that a bread company, Garner's Bakery, or whoever it is, who's delivering bread and pastries, is not substantially similar. So I go back to the plain meaning.
Now, counsel, we've got another issue in this case, so we should really turn to that. The Court of Appeals didn't decide whether your customer clause was valid, right?
Right.
But the customer clause says don't deal with any customer that's a customer of Star. Is that right?
Anybody who's been a customer of Star within the past year.
Yeah, okay, if you're here.
Within the past year, if you ever dealt with them on behalf of Star, or if you have some specialized information about them.
Okay, so if you're going to sell beer, you can't sell it to us, a customer of Star's.
No, because it doesn't say don't deal with them. It says don't entice away our customers if you dealt with them. It's a non-solicitation clause. It says don't entice away our customers if they were customers with us in the past year, and if you ever dealt with them, or if you have specialized knowledge about them. And that covenant is reasonable and necessary to protect a couple of important interests of Star's. One of them is the close relationship.
Can I stop you right
yes.
there? What in heaven's name does with specialized knowledge mean? Is that defined in the agreement?
Sure. There are some Supreme Court cases, and we've cited them in our brief, and I can't off the top of my head name them, but specialized knowledge is a term that comes from some Supreme Court cases where they use that particular term of art. And in this particular case, the record shows that specialized knowledge includes information about the customer, what they buy and what they like and those sorts of things. But the other interest that Star has especially is in knowledge, not about the customer, but it's price. Price of Star sells products. More importantly, the cost at which Star buys products.
But none of these things are defined in the agreement.
No, and we have that argument in the temporary restraining order stage of this case when the court granted the temporary restraining order, and that argument was made by Mr. Delpras' prior attorney, and an argument in the temporary restraining order, we successfully demonstrated to the court that specialized knowledge does have a meaning in the law and in this particular field.
Well, the circuit court found that all three of these provisions, the confidentiality one, the customer clause, and the business clause, were all overbroad.
But
what did the court zero in on in regard to the customer clause?
Well, as to the specialized knowledge, that argument was not advanced by Mr. Delpras after the temporary restraining order hearing. So I just want to be sure that that argument has not been pursued on summary judgment or on appeal or in this court. So I think that that's not an issue before the court. And I believe that what this...
Isn't an issue when we look at this particular clause?
I don't think the specialized knowledge one is because it's not been argued by either party in this case. The defendant abandoned that argument after the temporary restraining issue. But if it is, I've told you that the specialized knowledge is cited at least in the materials in the record in the temporary restraining order, and I've told you what the evidence is regarding what specialized knowledge is. But to answer your most recent question is, what did the circuit court say? The circuit court, I think, said there's no reason for a covenant not to compete to prevent Mr. Delpras from dealing with former customers, from enticing away former customers. And it's, I think the circuit court said that because if somebody decided not to leave Delpras, or decided to leave Star, we don't want to deal with you anymore, why should Mr. Deputy Protector, and my answer to that is Star has a legitimate interest in not allowing Mr. Delpras to use the confidential information he has, to use the close relationship he has with our recent customers, too. Our recent customers are important to us, just like our current customers are. Just because somebody stopped buying from us for a month, maybe because Mr. Delpras intentionally caused him to do that, or for 6 months, because some other competitor came along and said, tell you what, buy from us, we'll give you a discount on these products for a while, or we'll give you some free financing for a while, doesn't mean that Star does not have a legitimate interest in protecting Mr. Delpras from using his close relationship to go after their prospective customers. And we have to have some point in time to measure what a recent customer is, It can't be just the people who bought products yesterday. It can't be just the people who bought last week. We have to have some point in time to go back to say, when do we measure what a recent customer is so that we have a sufficient interest in preventing someone from using their close relationship and confidential information to unfairly compete with us immediately after they leave our employment. And of course, I've addressed the issue of divisibility in our brief, and I see we're out of time unless you have other questions.
Thank you, and you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel. Thank you. Siebold, Gregory P. Siebold, Brophy Desmond, representing the defendant, Eugene Delcroix.
May it please the court, my name is Greg Siebold of Murphy Desmond, representing respondent Eugene Delpra. I do want to address the substantial similarity issue a little bit later because I think there's some important points to be made there, but I'd like to focus on initially what I thought was the issue that the court is really interested in addressing in this particular case, and that is the divisibility issue, the issue that Judge Bergeron raised in her concurrence in the Court of Appeals. And I agree with Judge Bergeron when she says that the court should reassess the doctrine of indivisibility as it relates to competition in employment agreements, particularly with respect to the interaction between Section 103.465 and prior common law. Where I disagree with Judge Bergeron is any suggestion that somehow Brass interpreted Strife too broadly in its decision. This court has not addressed divisibility as it relates to restrictions on competition since Justice Abramson authored the Strife decision in 1984. This is true despite the fact that there's been prodigious litigation in the circuit court on non-competes and many cases in the Court of Appeals as well. And it's not simply a matter of clarifying Strife's idea of indivisibility, but revisiting what divisible really means under the prior common law blue pencil rule in light of Section 103.465. Strife addressed the impact of Section 103.465 on the Supreme Court's decision in Torborg, Fullerton Lumber v. Torborg, and the pre-existing common law blue pencil rule. The blue pencil rule essentially said, look, if you have a restraint that's divisible, the courts can enforce so much of the restraint that is reasonable but can't, period. The next part of the blue pencil rule said, but if you have a restraint that's indivisible, courts cannot enforce an indivisible and unreasonable covenant. Prior to 103.465, Section 103.465 in Torborg, the principal case in Wisconsin dealing with the divisible issue was General Bronze. And General Bronze involved a case where there was a company that manufactured bronze ornaments for like 50 years. Then what they did was they decided to sell the company to a buyer. The key employees signed non-compete agreements that prohibited them from competing in the United States, Mexico, and Canada. And what the court did was, the court said, we think that not competing in the United States is a reasonable restraint. However, not competing in Mexico and Canada is not a reasonable restraint. So because we can strike out the words Mexico and Canada, the restraint is divisible, and therefore we will strike those words and it becomes enforceable. In Torborg, this court said, well, even if, and in that case there was a restraint that was simply for 10 years, it didn't say, you may not compete for 2, 4, 6, 8, or 10 years, whichever the court deems is reasonable. It just said you can't compete for 10 years. And the court said, well, that's not divisible, but we still think that we can enforce this restraint to the extent that it is reasonable. Section 103.465 was enacted in response to that. And the court said you can't do that. You can't enforce indivisible restraints to the extent they are reasonable. Well, since that time, the idea of divisibility and what is divisible under General Bronze clearly isn't the law anymore. No court today would look at a clause that said You may not compete in America, Canada, and Mexico and strike out Canada and Mexico and apply it to the United States. That is, I think, generally accepted to be indivisible. So the pre 103.465 law of divisibility simply doesn't apply anymore. That doesn't mean that the common law doesn't apply. There are aspects of the common law that clearly still apply. The whole concept of reasonableness as to territory, reasonableness as to time.
So the question, what do you think the test ought to be?
I'm sorry?
What do you think the test ought to be in regard to divisibility or indivisibility?
I think the court can do one of two things. One, the court can throw out the idea of divisibility and just simply say, the covenants not to compete that are not reasonable are not enforceable, regardless of whether they're divisible. However, in light of strife and perhaps not wanting to make such a great departure, I think the more reasonable solution is for this court to clarify strife. And as I mentioned in the brief, predicate the idea of divisibility on the functional purpose of the particular clause. And what I mean by that is you can have a covenant not to compete. You will not attempt to solicit customers. You will not compete for our business. You can have a covenant not to solicit employees. That would be another type of functional purpose. You can have a confidentiality clause. All of those types of covenants have been recognized as falling under the purview of Section 103.465. And in preparation for our argument, I was thinking to myself, well, are there other areas? And there's one other potential area that I can think of as I stand here today, and that might be the idea, as is often found in employment agreements, that employers want to protect what they call inventions. So if an employee works on development of a product, and the employee may, you know, the light bulb goes on in his mind, and he knows how to build a better mousetrap, and so he decides to leave and takes the knowledge that he had. Oftentimes, employers want to protect themselves. That would be perhaps another. I think the number of types of covenants are limited, but that is a good thing because it actually provides some certainty in this area.
And I'm not so sure I understand your functional purpose of the clause. If we decide that, for instance, a business clause is different than a customer clause, then is different than a confidentiality clause, do we then say those are all divisible? Or what do we say? How do we apply your test?
Well, I think what the court would do is say, if we can discern that this agreement has three clauses, this one is narrowly drafted to cover non-competition within whether it's a particular area, whether it's a customer list or whatever, and it has a reasonable time, and it has a reasonable geographic scope, then it is enforceable. However, if there's another clause in that same agreement that deals with non-solicitation of employees, for example, and the court finds that that clause is unenforceable, for it's too broad for whatever reason, the court can say those are two separate covenants. They serve two separate purposes. This one may be not enforceable, but this other one is still enforceable. However, if you have a covenant, one covenant that says you may not compete for our customers, and you may not solicit our employees, and you may not divulge information, and it is unreasonable for whatever reason again, it is clearly not divisible, and all of those efforts to restrict post-employment activity are therefore unenforceable.
Well, let me see if I'm moving in the same direction as Justice Crux. The goal, if I understood your argument, is to get a definition or a criteria or guidelines for divisible or indivisible so that these guidelines are more easily and better applied in future cases that have diverse language, right? And what do you think Strife's test is?
I think Strife's test is that the separate clauses, they have to be distinct and mutually exclusive clauses governing separate activities and applying to distinct facts.
It says distinct, mutually exclusive, independent provisions that come into play in totally different fact situations so that the restraints are divisible. It goes on to say that there are three dimensions. The activity, what is the employee not to engage in? Time, what is the time? And geography. So if you have two different clauses and you test them against activity, time, and geography, isn't that a clue as to whether they're divisible or not?
I agree 100%, Justice Abrams. I agree 100%, Justice Abrams.
Okay.
And really what I'm suggesting is simply that my argument focuses on the activity dimension.
Well, that's the first dimension.
Correct. And I would simply suggest that this court clarifies strife to make clear what the activity dimension really means.
Okay, what do you want to do about the activity dimension?
Well, as I stated, I think...
Apply it here. Why don't you apply your definition in this case?
Sure. There are the business clause and the customer clause are two separate clauses. Actually, they're two separate paragraphs within the same subsection of this...
Okay.
Of this contract, and one of them says you can't compete for our customers, and the other one says your existing customers that you have contact with at any time, which is a problem, but for which they were employees, they are existing customers or former customers in the last year. The other one says you can't compete for our business, essentially, within a 50-mile radius. Both of those clauses govern the same activity. It is the attempt to solicit customers. Whether you call it competing for our business or whether you call it soliciting our customers, it is essentially the same thing.
Well, customers for what? I mean, if he became a chiropractor and went to these same people, would you be violating this code, this contract? Suppose he had an accounting degree and decided to go out of selling consumer goods, and he's going to be an accountant, and he goes to these same people within the 50-mile radius and says, how would you like me to do some accounting business for you? Is that a violation of this code?
Well, I think clearly not, and Justice Abramson, that would be what I would call looking at it at the 50,000-foot level, where everybody can agree that it doesn't apply, but where we get to the problem is at the 200-foot level where...
Well, then my real question is, I got trying to get it away from anything that really dealt with the business, because the business is not accounting, but now let's take any consumer product that's sold. Let's take beer.
Right.
Suppose I'm Bill Prawn, I'm going to go out and I'm just going to sell beer to these very same people, and... Star doesn't sell beer. Am I violating this contract, this covenant?
With all due respect, I'm not sure that's the right question. If it's assuming the
my
contract, if we assume the contract is enforceable, then I would say that. Perhaps it is, perhaps it isn't, depending upon what the lawyer decides, what the employer decides to say.
The reason I gave that example is for the reason that Justice Bradley said. If you view the activity of Star consumer products that are sold in a convenience store, which takes tractors out of it, that may be may or may not be a consumer product, but it takes them out of it, okay? But beer is a consumer product. It is sold or can be sold in a convenience store. So you have to interpret what this contract means for the activity dimension.
Exactly, and it's very difficult to do so, which is why I believe it's
But it seems to me your interpretation is it covers any product.
I think it does on its face.
At all.
That's correct, Your Honor. Justice. On its face, I think it does. It nowhere does it define... the business of the employer as anything more narrow than consumer products to convenience stores and gas stations, essentially.
Do you agree on the record, Counselor, that your client understood that it did not cover the sale of beer?
Actually, I don't know that that specific question is in the record. He may have answered it that way, but it depends on the level of your questioning. How close are you going to parse it? Does it apply to cough drops but not aspirin?
No, I just was talking about beer because that was the example that was brought up by opposing counsel. And Brett, I can look up the interrogatories. If they're in the record, we've got it, and I'll see what it says.
Yeah. And,
does it matter how your client answered it? Does it matter?
I don't think it does. That was what I was going to say. Because these, first of all, there's no ambiguity in the agreement. And we don't look at what the subjective intent of the parties was at the time unless we have ambiguity. And so that level of analysis, I don't think, is necessary. And when you look at this agreement on its face, it is overbroad. Substantially similar is not the same as substantially similar products. It's not the same as competitive products. And I think what's really important here is that this agreement has to be looked at. And I think prior case law doesn't emphasize a point that I think ought to be emphasized a little bit more, and it relates to the harshness or oppressiveness to the employee. And I would suggest to the court that these types of agreements, they have to be discernible by the employee so that the employee can know what the employee can or cannot do with respect to post-employment competition. If the employee has to guess, it has an interim effect.
Do you think that reasonable people could come to different conclusions about what substantially similar means?
Absolutely, I do.
Okay, well then isn't the agreement ambiguous, and then don't you look to the intent of the parties?
Yes and no. I think that substantial or substantially similar is relatively certain in common parlance. Okay, but it could be argued that it's reasonable if you apply it to these particular facts by saying, well, gee, does it apply to beer or doesn't apply to beer? But again, I think that the analysis has to be you take the language at face value, and because that's what the employee is going to have to do. The employee isn't in the position that they don't have the luxury of going into court all the time to find out whether a particular activity is reasonable or not. I would argue that although reasonable people can differ, it doesn't satisfy the standard of ambiguity for purposes of looking to the party's intent.
Would that be your answer, Mr. Seibel, to saving the business clause from overbreadth, competitive instead of substantially similar? Using the phrase competitive rather than substantially similar, I thought I understood you to say that a moment ago.
I would concede that if that agreement only said competitive, it might be enforceable, but I have to think back about the other aspects of the
clause. Wouldn't competitive products, by their definition, be those that are substantially similar?
No, I think competitive products are using the standard rules of construction as opposing counsel rightly suggests we should do, we have to give meaning to both of them, and both substantially similar and competitive. And it's in the disjunctive. It's substantially similar or competitive products. So competitive products and substantially similar have to mean something different. Substantially similar, I would argue on its face, means products that are not competitive but are substantially similar to competitive products. So
substantially similar product, to use the Chief Justice's hypothetical, Oreo cookies. What would be substantially similar?
Oreo cookies?
Yes.
Doritos.
What would be competitive?
The Oreo cookies, if that's the actual product that's being sold by Star under the hypothetical.
Then why not just say the same?
They could have done that, and perhaps it would have been enforceable, but that's not what this agreement provides. This agreement provides competitive or substantially similar. And substantially similar, by definition, can't be just competitive products. And there is no particular interest in keeping Delpra from selling substantially similar but not competitive products.
Counsel, as I read on Appendix 49, page 4 of the employment contract,
substantially similar or true or in competition with the business. So to read the whole phrase, become engaged in any business which is substantially similar to or in competition with the business. Now, as I heard the discussion, we're talking about substantially similar to or in competition to the product. Do those words modify products elsewhere in the contract, or are the substantially similar words or in competition words that you've just been referring to the ones that I've identified, the location?
If I understand the question, I wholly agree that perhaps the previous discussion we had was inaccurate to the extent we were talking about products as opposed to the business.
It seems to me there's at least arguably, conceptually a difference. You know, products, I don't know, arguably could be more narrow than a business. In other words, what it says is become engaged in any business which is substantially similar to or in competition with the business of the employer.
And I would agree, Justice Bradley, it is a broader statement related to the business as a whole. And so when you do the analysis of a business that is substantially similar, you become even more uncertain about what exactly is prohibited and what is not prohibited. And again, the agreements have to be looked at from the standpoint of the employee. The employee has to know, what can I do and what can't I do? Because if these clauses are overbroad, they have an interim effect. That is what Stripe recognized, and that was the explicit public policy purpose of the Wisconsin legislature in enacting 103.465. There's the quote of the legislative history. I believe it's a report of the legislative history in the Stripe decision. And I would submit to the court that it doesn't matter if a clause is an indivisible clause that says you may not compete within 50 miles, you may not solicit our customers, you may not use confidential information that is unreasonable, or whether there are separate paragraphs that say you may not do this and you may not do that and you may not do that, and one of them is unreasonable. The bottom line is, from the employee's perspective, there is going to be that interim effect. There is going to be that effect on the employee. I better not do anything because I might be violating one of these clauses, even though that employee could engage in entirely lawful activity that is ostensibly prohibited.
Okay, so draft it the way it should have been drafted. I mean, because, of course, employers have to be able to have non-compete clauses if it's negotiating, that this isn't an extinct form of a clause in a contract. There has to be some kind of contract clause that can be drafted. So tell me how you would draft it so that it's enforceable.
With respect to the...
With respect to the non-compete. With respect to the business clause. Try that.
All right.
What should it say?
Well, first of all, what I would suggest is you can't have separate paragraphs in that subsection that attempt to do the same thing.
So you should break it out, make it more clear.
Well, not break it out, actually. Make it one paragraph. And the employer needs to do a careful analysis of what is necessary and narrowly tailored in order to protect my legitimate interests. And if it's best to put that in terms of a no contact with customers clause, do that. But what you can't do is make a no contact with customers clause, and then on top of that have a radius that says you can't compete within that area because they overlap. The you can't compete within that area includes existing customers, which is also covered by the customer clause. So if you remember the Venn diagram.
The customer clause doesn't say you can't talk to any former customers. It says you shall not interfere with or endeavor to entice away from the employer
Correct.
So if you're going to go distribute beer to them, or in the Chief Justice's example, you're going to ask them, could I do your accounting, you're not going to have a problem with the custom clause, right? You're not enticing them away from Star if you're going to do their accounting.
Agreed.
Okay. And you aren't enticing them away from Star if you're selling them beer, right?
You may very well be.
Okay.
Well, you start with beer, and then what's next? And by the way, when you get a year down the road, how do you know what the employer is selling now?
Okay, thank you.
And I don't mean to be facetious about that, Justice. I think opposing counsel conceded that the product mix can change. So how does an employee know a year down the road whether that is a product that is competitive?
You could call Star up and ask them.
Is this a standard employment contract, or where did this language come from?
Well, I know it was drafted, and the record would reflect that it was drafted by Star Direct. Beyond that, I do not believe there's anything in the record concerning particular negotiations. In fact, this agreement arose out of Star's purchase of the business of CB Distributors. And so Star required, as part of that purchase, that Mr. Delcroix sign this agreement in order to try and protect the business that it just bought. Getting back to Justice Bradley's question, I think that the clause has to be discreet, has to be narrowly tailored, and then and the law is rather certain with respect to time. 2 years is kind of the accepted time limit, unless you have particular circumstances that that would indicate otherwise. The real question comes with respect to geographic scope. And what you're trying to accomplish in terms of non-competition. And I think that the answer is that employers need to narrowly draft those types of clauses. And if they, what they can't do is use a shotgun approach, which is kind of what's going on here. You know, you can't compete this way, and you can't compete this way using slightly different parameters, whether it be geographic or time or customer clause, and then, you know, count on one of them being enforced. And again, the other point I would make is that I think that the divisible area makes sense post-strife when you look at the activity dimension in terms of the types of things that are trying to be accomplished, whether it be keeping records confidential, protecting solicitation from employees, etc.
Did Mr. Delcroix have any input in the drafting of this employment agreement contract?
My recollection of the record is there's nothing that indicates that he did. However, I can't make the absolute affirmative statement that he didn't, in all honesty.
Did he have counsel? Did counsel?
Not that I'm aware of.
I mean, are we to take basically that the employer said, here's an employment contract, if you want to work here, sign this.
My understanding is that's essentially how it worked. There was some negotiation offered. They offered him the $30,000 if he would remain for 3 years, which he did, and he was paid that amount, but he fulfilled his obligation in that regard. But
are you saying
there may have been some give and take.
Are you saying that bonus was not standard? I mean, that was something for him or not?
The bonus was offered to him. Whether it has been offered to other employees, I do not know. I do know that this type of agreement was not systemically used by the employer. In fact, the two-prong business clause, customer clause, was something that Star admits they did in particular for Mr. Delcroix. And also, In a similar purchase of a business by Star Direct, another business besides CP Distributors, Star acquired 5 employees that it did not require to sign no-compete agreements at all. And Mr. Sun, the president of Star, said, well, I thought that wouldn't be a good idea because if I required them to sign a non-compete agreement, they might refuse and go out and compete right away. So what I was going to do is try and reshuffle their customers and address it that way. He could have done the same thing with Mr. Dalpois, and he didn't. And what that shows is that this particular agreement was not necessary for the protection of Star, because if it was, Star would have systematically imposed these kinds of agreements on all its employees, which it clearly didn't do.
Isn't there something in the record to indicate that that was the product of Mr. Delpra's bargaining, that he said, gee, I don't want to go more than 50 miles, I think it was away from Rockford. And so didn't he take some part in bargaining this agreement?
And he may have. Mr. Sun put that in his affidavit, and it's not controverted in the record.
And so, therefore, wouldn't there be a commensurately higher need to, from the employer's standpoint, to protect themselves against one who is becoming so intimately familiar? I mean, in this kind of business, and it's in the record, the personal relationships that are built up over the course of years are very, very important because of the low profit margin of the products that are being sold. And so, therefore, who you have in that job is very important. Doesn't that have some play in this?
Clearly, Chuck Wagon and other cases in Wisconsin have recognized that an employer has an interest in protecting its interest with respect to customer route salespersons for the reasons that you stated. However, Wisconsin law is also clear that what you need to do is evaluate the purported necessity in light of the language that's used.
Sure, I agree with that, but I guess that was a corollary to what Justice Prosser was asking about whether Mr. Delpra had any input into the contract. He had some input, it seems.
Well, what the record reflects is Mr. Delpra said, I'd really like to stay within 50 miles of Rockford. And so the employer decided to impose this clause because of that. Not that Mr. Delpra said, so I would agree to this second clause. There's nothing in the record that says that.
But that might help explain why the other five were not asked to sign these agreements.
Well, they were asked not to sign any agreement at all.
Right.
And the concerns of the employer, I would submit, could have been just as easily addressed without using a 50-mile radius, that the business clause, the customer clause, could have been crafted to accomplish the same thing.
Well, it seems to me, would you at least concede that it's a reasonable argument to make that they needed a higher level of protection in regard to a non-compete for Mr. Delpra than they would have had someone who was not so narrowly limited into geography?
Not to quibble, but I think the interest is the same. The interest is with respect to the contact with customers, whether it's within 50 miles or not within 50 miles. And I expect what counsel is going to say, but is that Mr. Delpra was responsible for soliciting prospective customers within 50 miles. And so that is why it becomes reasonable. But the problem is that it still overlaps with the customer clause, because customers, existing customers within 50 miles, are covered by both clauses. And so therefore, and I'm getting back to the divisibility argument, not to mean to sidetrack you, but that's why both are unenforceable. And that the issue of the prospective customers could give an employer a reason to try and define that and protect that interest, which might be an additional interest beyond other employees. But the question still becomes, did they do that within the law in this particular agreement, and
sure,
for all the reasons that I've said?
Thank you.
No. Thank you.
I believe that Justice Gableman and Mr. Siebel have responded to some things I wanted to say in response to Mr. Justice Prosser's question. So I would like to focus on the test. I think we don't really need to get to the test in this case, because I think both covenants are enforceable as a matter of contract construction. And that's all in the briefs and all that's there. But the more interesting question that the court can give some guidance to the public on, if it chooses to, is this test. And I suggest that the test starts with the statute.
The test for divisibility?
The test for divisibility. And again, I don't think the court needs to get there, but I realize that's what brought us here. So we could probably all go to lunch, but I don't get to do this very often, so I think we ought to take 5 minutes to do it. The test starts with the statute. I think Mr. Siebel is correct. the statute did change the blue penciling rule that was adopted in Torborg. The blue penciling rule was sort of a Frankenstein veto plus, because it allowed the court to actually take a blue pencil and change a number from 10 to 3. Torborg said you can't do that anymore. It may also be true that, or the statute said you can't do that anymore. I think it's also true that the statute may have changed the common law before Torborg. I'm not so clear about that, but it may have. The common law before Torborg seemed to be that you could blue pencil within a covenant. You could cross out Canada or United States, Greene County or Monroe County. But what the statute did is something different, and that's where your court has to start with the question. That's where divisibility comes from. It's in the statute. Because what the statute says is that if you have a covenant not to compete that is unreasonable in that respect, then that entire covenant is unenforceable in its entirety. It doesn't say if you have one covenant not to compete in an employment contract, then every other covenant not to compete is unenforceable.
So what's your test?
So the test is we start with the statute with the understanding that there can be separate covenants not to compete in a standard. And I've outlined it at the beginning of page 30 of our brief. The second, you look to the intent of the parties. Did they intend these to be separate obligations? Well, in this case, you see that they did. They had one covenant not to compete during the term of employment. They had another covenant not to compete with, not to entice away customers. And that, to answer Justice Process, that's common in these employment agreements, a non-solicitation type covenant not to compete. You will not attempt to solicit away our customers. And then they had another covenant that said, you, Mr. Delcroix, will not engage in substantially similar business. And that was particularly negotiated with Mr. Delcroix because he wanted something different than the other people had. He wanted to work close to home, and so he said, fine, you have more responsibility for developing businesses and so on. So he looked to the intent of the parties. Then you look, do the covenants serve some different purposes, or they do all the same thing? The question is not whether they overlap. The question is whether they serve some different interest of the employer. Here, one covenant protects the customers. That deals with the confidential relationship that may exist between a salesman and his customers, and it protects confidential information that the employer has or the employee has about the employer or about the customers. The second covenant deals with somebody engaged in a competing business in the same territory where he had the responsibility for developing business. So it gets at an interest different than the first one of protecting prospective customers. Now, they do overlap, but that's not the test of whether they overlap. Next part of my test is, do they stand separate and can they be evaluated separately? In Strife, all the court reached in Strife was the fact that the covenants in Strife it was impossible to separate them out. And the court said, here they are so intertwined, we must view them at one. And the court said, we're not going to address in Strife what happens if one covenant is reasonable as to geography, territory, and product, and the other one is not. So Strife doesn't deal with this case. So we look at, do they stand alone? And then on top of that, you look at, are these covenants a subterfuge for the statute? Are we trying to get around what the statute says? And all of this has to be viewed in the totality of circumstances. The court has said these covenants not to compete need to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis, looking at all these things. So if I came in here with a covenant not to compete, and the first covenant said, you will not compete with Star in a radius from 1 to 10 miles from Rockford, Illinois. And the second covenant said, you will not compete with Star in a radius from 10 to 20 miles from Rockford, Illinois. And the third one, let's see, that would obviously be not serving separate interest. It would not be something that is not a subterfuge around the rule of blue penciling.
Counsel, why is it necessary to enforce this covenant not to compete if there are different salespeople for Star that don't have a covenant not to compete? In other words, meeting the words of the statute that the covenant has to be necessary for the protection of the employer.
And what the record shows there is when Mr. Sun bought the business from somebody else, their existing salespeople did not have covenants not to compete. He concluded that they ought to have them and systematically began implementing them. He did not choose to fire those people who didn't have them or to require them to sign one for fear that they might leave. And instead, the record shows he took some other steps to deal with those people who were employed by the company before he bought it, such as himself becoming very closely involved with those customers so that he maintained a close relationship with him. So the fact that those particular clients, the customers, salesmen don't have a covenant is not because it's not necessary. It's because the systematic process of imposing it has taken some time. Mr. Sun chose to do it in some other ways.
Have the salesmen hired subsequent to that been required to sign?
Yes, and that's in the record.
Thank you, Mr. Shimarka. And thank you, Mr. Seibold, for your arguments this morning in yet another covenant case in employment. That concludes the hearing on 07AP617, Star Direct versus Dalprah. The court is in recess until 1:30 for its final argument today.